I'm Charlie Nesson. I, together with Jonathan Zittrin up here on my left, had the pleasure of... had the pleasure some years ago of founding the Berkman Center. It was the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. It was actually a good idea. The idea not only of recognizing that the Internet was going to affect all of our futures, but recognizing that its connection with society was a grounding for looking at it that would rise above and engage the legal and the policy and the educational aspects of it. Wonderful aspiration, and from the beginning, it was an enterprise that depended on the brilliance of young people. I used to think of Jonathan Zittrin as the most brilliant young man that I knew, but I no longer think of him.
Thanks a lot, Gramps.
The two gentlemen that I'm eager to introduce to you, I regard as the two brilliant stars, young stars, of the Berkman Center. Not to eclipse John, he's just old now. That's all. These two hold an image in my mind, which I formed at the wedding of Colin McClay, now our acting director. This was a wedding that took place on Martha's Vineyard, and in the run-up to the wedding, there were some festivities, and there was a run. Everybody out on the road and running. And somewhere along the end of that, as I'm waiting, I'm not running myself, I'm smarter than that, I see these two, to me, they look like young gods, running side by side, palfrey and gasser. They're tall, they're lanky, they're athletic, they're powerful, they are a team. And somehow these two became a team from almost the first that worst appeared on our doorstep. And they have been the most remarkable team ever since. You have tonight the fruit of their collaboration in this book about which I won't say a word. But you should also know that they are now completely wedded in collaboration, as John Palfrey has stepped from being the executive director of the Berkman Center to being a professor of law, a librarian, our vice dean for information here at Harvard, and Urs has come in to be our new executive director, stepping right in back of John. And so this sense of team, I don't myself feel that we lost John at all by having him now elevated. We just have expanded our purview, so to speak. And to have the two of them as a team to continue in the ideas that they have taken up and put forward in such a wonderful fashion with this book is just about as exciting and optimistic as anything I can think of in relationship to the Berkman Center. Now this book, Digital Natives Born Digital, the idea of a book that describes a generation of people, that articulates who they are, how they operate, and which speaks ostensibly, as I was reading it, to me, in a way, the older generation, the people who are not themselves digital natives, but are somehow confronted with their fears of seeing these digital natives so empowered and so able to move in an environment which may seem increasingly alien to older folk. But the thing that struck me most about the book as I read it was that it was also possible to take a view of its audience from the other side, conceiving of the digital native as a constituency and recognizing the need of digital natives to understand themselves, their own practices, and most particularly their own rights in relationship to creative enterprise of which they are deeply engaged. That was a perspective that I had seen take root in earlier occasions of the Berkman Center, but hadn't yet before this book seen it so well wrought, so well put together, and so well crafted to a design for the future. So, for example, just to be specific, one of the projects that I see growing right out of this book, the two of them now involved in it, involves literally an education program designed for an online environment to engage young creators who are interested in knowing what their creative rights are. Not an approach that says, you can't do this, or if you do this, you'll be fined, or you'll be sued, or you'll be prosecuted and put in prison, but rather an approach that says, you may use things in the following ways and are completely within your rights to do so. You may parody, you may go to the limits of fair use, and an approach that is addressed to that audience and empowering of that audience in terms of sensitizing it to its own capacity for affecting the environment in which the law has become so stiff in the past and so clearly needs to loosen up. So it is with just the greatest pleasure that I introduce these two young champions to you. And I wish them well. I hope every one of you buy their book and make both of them sign a personal message. So I don't know which of you is to come first, but how did you both come up somehow, or what?
How are you?
Thank you very much, Doug. Charlie, for this wonderful introduction. Of course, you've been a source of inspiration for both of us for a very long time, and we appreciate your support and your vision and your guidance of many of our projects. Very warm welcome also from my side. I'm thrilled and slightly overwhelmed to be here with you tonight to celebrate with you the birth of Born Digital. So we're a little bit proud of that, of course. But it's also important to say that this book, or tonight, it's not only about a book, it's actually about a research project, a long-term research project, the Digital Natives Project, and this book is only one piece of this longer and larger conversation about kids, children, young adults, and the ways in which they use media. So I just arrived from Europe, I landed about 2.5 hours ago, so still slightly jet-lagged, of course. And John is always so kind to me, and he suggested, well, you could do like the easygoing introduction, and then, you know, I will take care of the substance and we'll do the heavy lifting.
That's not what I said.
So I, no surprise, immediately accepted this very kind offer. And so, you know, I thought I'm starting off with a few questions that have been repeatedly asked. John has given many interviews over here. I've been interviewed quite a bit in Europe about the book and the project. And so there are a number of questions that we hear over and over again, and I just wanted to start with those and share some of the answers with you before we move then to the content of the book itself. One of the questions that journalists seem to be particularly interested in is, why the heck did you write this book? Well, fair question, right? What were the reasons why you started actually to work on digital natives and youth and technology. Now, I think there are roughly three reasons why we got interested in that. First of all, it's obvious, both John and I, we are researchers. We like to do research, and we've been studying the internet and digital technologies for about 10 years by now. And we've been working on many different projects, ranging from interoperability to privacy issues to free speech issues, filtering, broad range of issues, loosely related at a glance. However, there has been a common thread through all these projects we did, and this kind of the essential question, what is special about the internet? How is the internet different from previous technologies? And what difference does the internet make in our lives? How does it change society? How does it change the way we communicate? How does it change the way we relate to information and to our institutions in this society? And many more questions, but at the core, the question of what makes the internet different and how does the internet change our lives. So kind of identifying structural changes, analyzing them, and assessing them is kind of the larger project we're involved in as researchers. Now, it seems quite natural that and logical that digital natives, this population born around 1980 with access to broadband technology, to digital technologies, and the skills to use this technology, is like a great point of crystallization, so to speak, to study some of these changes. They become most visible there, these changes, how the internet shapes the way we communicate. If you look at the way, for instance, our kids are using our cell phones and playing around with it, it's very interesting. So that's the first reason. The second reason, we are both teachers. And of course, as teachers, we have this desire, right, to share knowledge and to communicate about our findings and about our research projects. And here we decided to share the knowledge not only from our research, because the book, of course, heavily builds upon the research of many of you actually in this room and out there, to share some of these insights with a broader audience. Not to write the law review article, but to write the book for a broader audience. That was the second reason. The third reason, we are both parents, and we care deeply about the future of our children. We care about the ways in which Jack and Ananda and Emmy and Dave will communicate with each other in the future, how they can access content, how they can share information. We're also concerned, right, with some of the things we see, some of the things that are associated while we move from a paper world to this digital world. Privacy issues, safety issues, we will come back to that in a second. Challenges, how do kids make sound quality judgments when it comes to online information? These are concerns that we want to address, that we want to help to solve or to sort out. Of course, we're also very enthusiastic about the new opportunities that come with this great, wonderful new digital technology. We are eager to get a better sense how we could use the internet to educate our own children and their peers. What does the internet mean for learning, for innovation, for participation? So it's this kind of deep care and passion about these issues, having two kids each on two different continents that also motivated us to write this book. Now, a second question was, why did you write a book? Since you're describing a generation that is not expected to read long texts anymore, right? Why would you read a book in the first place? Now, as I mentioned, this book aims at bridging a gap between, let me say, generations, in untechnical terms, because there's, of course, a lot to be differentiated about age groups and so forth. But it aims to bridge a gap between those who are very familiar with the digital technologies and those who are less familiar with this technology or not familiar at all. So, and this generation that is not familiar with the technology still reads books. So, you know, therefore we decide this may be still an appropriate format. Now, to be honest with you, it took us a few gin and tonics to find the courage to write and decide to write the book for parents and teachers, because usually our targeted audience are policymakers or lawyers. So we had to have some courage to write this sort of book. But as I said, the goal is to start a conversation across generations. The third question that I've been asked, and John as well, over the past few weeks and months repeatedly, is how long did it take to write this book? And how did you make use of digital technologies while writing this book, while doing the research? It took us about 4 years, 3.5, 4 years to do the research for this book. To, you know, start the conversations, to shape the idea, to launch the broader project behind the book, the Digital Natives Project. And the actual writing took about a year. Now, how did we use the internet while writing a traditional book? And I think this is now quite interesting. Of course, much of the research we've done is based on the internet, right? The things, the phenomena we describe in the book are obviously happening mostly in the online space. So you want to be familiar with this online space when you write about it. So you do a lot of surfing and you get money for it, for surfing the internet, which is very nice. And many of the research, the papers and, you know, narratives and reports that have been used to write this book are also, of course, available online. So, you know, we did a lot of research online. The second use of technology was basically that we used a wiki, the at digitalnative.org. You will find many of the materials we collected and shared with our team, with our researchers, to test out some of our hypotheses, to find good narratives for the book, also to expose our views to criticism, and to solicit feedback and inputs from our peers. So the wiki has become like the platform for this book. The third use of technology in this project has been that we used an application called Basecamp, where we shared our drafts, where we posted our drafts of the chapters of this book, allowing researchers from here as well as from St. Gallen, where actually I'm physically located, well, not mostly on airplanes, but in theory I'm based in St. Gallen in Switzerland. So, you know, we posted it in this web space, Basecamp, and the teams could work on the chapters, read it and correct it, make suggestions, give feedback, and repost it. And finally, we are using the internet very much to be part of this larger conversation, where this book hopefully is one small contribution to it. And that is, you know, to think about the chances, the opportunities, but also the risks of these new media usages by children and kids. And it's quite interesting. Recently we got a review of the book, and before the review was published, the reviewer was so kind to post the review on our wiki and allowed us and our team and the public at large to post comments and to start a conversation not only about the book and the review, but about the issues that were addressed in the review itself. So you can also see writing a book in this digital age has no clear starting point and doesn't necessarily have a clear end. So this is very much the beginning of a conversation and not the end of it. I had another interview yesterday and I got a very good question. This was probably the best question I got regarding, you know, this process of writing the book. The question was, well, what has been the highlight while you've been working with John and your teams, while you've been working on the project? What are the highlights? It's a tough question because, to be honest with you, we really had a great time writing this book and doing the research together with many of our colleagues. But so it's impossible to have a comprehensive list of highlights. But if I'd have to pick three, and John may have different three, here they are. First, among the highlights, certainly our conversations with digital natives. We've been traveling a lot over the past few years. We've traveled to Africa, we've traveled to Asia, we've traveled to the Middle East, traveled across Europe, across the US. There are many, many conversations with young people, with digital natives, and learned a lot from them, got a lot of inspiration from them with regard to what we try to describe in this book. And each conversation, in a way, for me, and I'm sure also for John, was a highlight. The second one, more on a personal note, has to do with our wonderful editor, Laura Heimert, at Basic Books. She's a terrific editor. And the book, I think, would never have happened this way without her help and guidance. And in the process of writing the book, she got really into Facebook. And this is quite remarkable, because as you can imagine, two law professors writing a book like this, right, there may be some issues with deadlines. So, you know, yes, it happened. Sometimes our draft chapters were slightly delayed. Laura first tried to send reminders via email. Well, you know, we get a lot of emails, and that was not a particularly successful strategy. But then she discovered that she could blame us in public on Facebook.
By writing on our walls and saying, you're really a bad author.
So this has been another highlight.
Thanks, Laura, for this and many other things. But again, she's a wonderful, best editor I can imagine. And the third highlight, and no doubt, and very serious, is, of course, the experience to work with many of you in this room. Some of our mentors are here, Charlie, Terry, Jonathan, Jochai isn't here tonight, but many more from our teachers, from our mentors that helped us to shape the argument of this book. Whether they agree or disagree with the outcome, we will see later tonight. But of course also many of our researchers are in the room, Corina, Senia, Miriam is somewhere, Erin is somewhere. A wonderful team of researchers, core team of Digital Natives Project, and of course many student researchers who can't name them all, will see it in the acknowledgements. Thank you, it's been a terrific experience, and certainly my highlight of writing this book to work with you. With that, I turn it over to you.
Thank you so much. What the book actually says and what we were up to with it. And of course, I hope that you will also read the book, but here's the argument that we make. Laid out here in a in an outline, but the basic idea of this book is a myth-busting book, first and foremost. I think the conversations that we had with our colleague researchers, and Dana Boyd, are you in the room?
Right there.
He's outside. Anyway, if you ever have a conversation with Dana about young people and how they use technologies, it's always animated, and it's almost always about what other people don't get, what the data actually say. And this book really was to say, could we surface the data that are out there about how young people use these technologies and bust some of the myths? And I think the three myths that we started with, and I hope to some extent will convince you of, are core to that. But then secondly, to shine a spotlight on some of the just extraordinary things that young people are doing here. Alexander Heppner of Scoop08 is here. It's a great honor that he's come. We have Diana Kimball and others who have made some great videos we'll show you. But truly, the extraordinary things that young people are doing with these technologies, and which get obscured, I think, by these myths and by the fear. The three myths, just to hit them off the bat, really have to do with how young people are using these technologies, and ultimately who these young people are. So there's kind of a meta myth before the first three, and we're alluded to this. There's a term, digital natives, that we use in this book, which we use to describe young people born after 1980 who have the skills to use these technologies and access to them. It's a controversial term. There are people in this room who hate the term, but we grabbed it in part because we wanted to make a strong argument about this. It's not actually a generation around the world. It's actually a population, is what we found, that there are only a billion people, period, who are on the internet in the world. So start there. There are 5 billion people who are not a part of this story. And then within the United States, there are lots of young people who don't have the skills to use or don't have supportive families and are using the technology in very different ways. Esther Hargitay and Henry Jenkins have made this great case about the participation gap that I think is one of the key findings of our study. Okay, some other myths, which I think we'll start debunking in a moment. But describe, first of all, what are these digital natives and how do they use this technology? How many bloggers are in the room? Dr. Searles, Marcus Goble, we have some real bloggers here. This is great. This is great. So one aspect of these young people is that they shape their identities in a way that's not just what they put on to wear when they walk to school. That there is an identity that's shaped in an online space. It's shaped by writing to a web blog. It's shaped by the profiles they create in MySpace and Facebook and so forth. And very often it's more than one identity, right? There are multiple identities that are created in these spaces, but they don't distinguish between them. So it's just identity. It's not a digital identity and an offline identity. And while most young people do create something and create these identities in social networks, there are some who do somewhat more dramatic things. So we point to Second Life, for instance. How many people have an avatar in Second Life? A good room to look for avatars. The Global Kids team gave us this example of a young person who's created quite a different version of who they are and who experiment with that identity in ways that may be positive sometimes or also less so. Okay, second attribute of young people in this category, in this population, is multitasking. Urs mentioned that one of the ways in which we had come at this book was actually as a teacher. So as a teacher in this very room, often, it's a quite different experience than the experience that I have right now. Most of you are looking at me. A few people are probably typing Persephone there as I'm blogging or working on a paper that she's going to turn in shortly. In a classroom at the Hotel School, there would be a laptop in front of every single person, and they would all be looking into the laptop, not at me, unless you're one of these extraordinary teachers who say laptop down and then teach the old-fashioned way. But very often, the young people we talk to have got many things going on at once, and there's a discussion as to whether that's multitasking or is it something else. Diana Kimball has a great argument about this, which I'm sure she'll make later, about switch tasking and so forth. But there's a quality to doing many different things at once. In one of the interviews we did in South Korea, I had a fun experience talking to a bunch of young boys. And they were describing this multitasking thing that they do. They have a game, and the game is on the screen at once. They have multiple IM windows going. And the game is how many girls can they talk to at once without telling the other girls that they've got other girls within this group and messing it up. It's like 8 or 10 going at once, which is impressive. So third attribute is the presumption that the media that they're interacting with is in a digital form, in a malleable form. So if you take a picture right now, as really anybody, I suppose, right now, it's not about taking a photograph, taking a roll of film, not walking to CVS, getting it printed out, right? Of course, Doc is taking pictures right here, and he just deletes them if they stink, and he puts them right on Flickr in a moment. And the same is true of every form of media that we looked at. Music, of course, most famously, and this was one of the findings of our research that was probably not debunking a myth, ultimately. Take music for a moment, which is when we asked our focus group and interview subjects, how do you get your music? Virtually every single one said that they downloaded their music from the internet, right? How surprising is this? Not very. Tower Records liquidated its stores a few years ago. We now have the evidence that iTunes is the number one music retailer in the United States. And when you ask these young people, so which service did you use? The vast majority will tell you under the sort of cloak of anonymity, of course, in a research setting, that it's LimeWire, it's Kazaa, it's one of the services that's illegal. And then you get into a conversation of whether they knew it was illegal and so forth. But a very, very small number of people would say they downloaded music from iTunes or from one of the for pay services. And in every instance that I talked to, that young person had somebody pay for the music for them. They'd gotten a gift card, right, from a parent or a relative. So you think about it, everybody's doing exactly the same thing with this digital media, downloading it from the internet, whether or not their parent paid or not, was the only distinction that we found in that context. Another thing that we found as teachers, not uncommon among these young people, is that the creation of digital media was a big part of the story as well. It wasn't just consuming it, but it was in fact creating it and then sharing it. And this is one, I think, of the big opportunities we have with this group of young people. I don't think we as teachers teach young people to work in teams and to use these technologies in the way that they're showing us that they can. As one way to demonstrate the creativity that we were looking for and hoping to point to, we needed a logo early in the project, and Aaron Mishkin and Miriam Simone, the coordinators, had the great idea, why don't we do a contest? Put out a contest and say, give us a logo. I don't think we offered much. We might have offered the recognition that they made a logo for Harvard Research Project. Isn't that great? We put it out to young people, and remarkably enough, we got 176 entries from 45 designers. Here was the winner. This was a boy from England, Brandon Kobe, who we did not know. And Brandon gave us 32 entries over time. Responded to critiques and comments and remade it. And the moment of recognition that a generation ago, it would absolutely not have been possible to put out this call to young people around the world, say, give me a free logo. I realize it sounds exploitative now when I say it. to demonstrate this creativity, and someone we didn't know in England who gave us this beautiful logo, for which we're grateful. Thank you, Brandon, wherever you are. You made a great point for us here. Another thing we found in the way that they learned was lightweight collaboration, the ability to use these tools, the Web 2.0 things that we talk about. They're richly being taken up among this body of young people. Again, the ones with the sophisticated skills, not the ones on the other side of the participation gap, but great opportunities here to collaborate. And sometimes, though, this collaboration comes with some wrinkles to it, and wrinkles that cause parents to worry a bit. And we'll segue from here, the attributes, to what some of the worries are. So how many people here have couch surfed? All right. Do you mind pressing your button and telling us about your couch surfing experience? Christy, go ahead.
So I went to a conference in Canada, and my advisor paid for my flight ticket, but not a hotel. So I went online, and people, I'm a PhD student. I was met at the airport by two undergrads who met me with two beers, took me back to the house, gave me more beer, some very bad food, and a sofa for 3 days. They're really, really nice. It probably wouldn't have been my ideal location, but they're really cool. I had never met them before. They had read my blog, I think. They read my blog before, or at least they read it before I arrived. About me. And it was really, really nice. It was a really useful, enjoyable experience. And it was way more fun exploring Ottawa with a local to show me around.
So basically, you're a graduate student. You've got got long hair and you're really smart and you go online and you say, I'm going to Canada and I'm going to be in the city and I need a place to stay. And then other people in Canada say, I've got a place for you and I'll meet you at the airport for the year. So couch-surfing is a wild phenomenon. It's one of the things that I think give rise to some of the concerns that stem out of this fact. I love the statistics that have been put over here. They're a little out of date, but you can see there are 195,200 couch surfers.
Now to 735,511.
Awesome. So since we printed this out, it is just mushroomed as Web2.0 applications do. We'll be able to update the stats in a moment, but this is always confusing. There have been 50,000 successful surveys, not that surprising, I guess, but then 89,000 friendships created on top of those 50,000 successful surveys. I wonder what happens to create all those extra friendships.
They now claim 660,000 successful surf or host experiences, 802,000 friendships created.
They're still running ahead of those friendships.
Yes. It goes a little because if you have a terrible experience and they kill you, you can't buy them.
But the set of technologies that have enabled this, again, is one of those things that I really think does set apart this generation from those who came before, but also some extent to which it presents problems that, understandably, parents might have some concerns about. Okay, so big section two. What are those threats? Some of them real, some of them perceived. The first one, inevitably, is the one that comes out of the couch surfing example. Many of us in the room have been taking part in something called the Internet Safety Technical Task Force. Over the course of a mind-numbing day, we heard from 15 different companies providing technology solutions to keep kids safer online. And this is something that in every one of our discussions with parents, safety is the first thing that they worry about, that these kids are, in fact, less safe than they were before. And this is really a big myth, I think one that we absolutely have to put out there, which is it is not that safety is not a concern. It is, absolutely, for all of our kids, for our 6-year-old, for our 3-year-old, and on and on. It's that these kids are more in danger than kids were 10 years ago or a generation ago. This is one of the things I think the data is incontrovertible on, which is kids are not less safe today than they were. In fact, many of the data point the other direction, that there are fewer abductions, for instance, than there were 10 years ago. What has changed, of course, substantially, though, is that the public spaces, the networked publics in which young people are leading their lives, have turned into these online spaces or these hybrid combined spaces, online and offline. And I think that's a crucial, crucial myth that we try to work out. So a second one, which is not, I think, in any way a myth, is concerns about young people and privacy. There's a lot of concern that young people do put a lot of information about themselves in public spaces for other people to see, and sure enough, that's true. There is no doubt, I think, from our own experiences, that young people do share a lot of information about themselves, and sometimes too much. And I think when we look at what are the myths that we want to sort of work through and what are the realities that may be understated, I think privacy is one of those. I surprised myself in the course of this research. I'm not a privacy guy. I sort of wonder what those privacy nuts are worried about. Like, what are they hiding? But if you think about the extraordinary amount of information that somebody born digital today would have created about them and how that kind of adds up over time, the dossier that they're creating. No one has lived cradle to grave in a digital age. So if you think about a young person born today, their sonogram might in fact be taken at, what, month 5, I suppose, in the pregnancy. And there's a digital file. One is in the obstetrician's file, one's in the pediatrician's file ultimately. There's also a nice hard copy on the fridge, right, that the proud parents put up there. And basically everything along the way is preserved in some digital file, held in different hands. And I think when we look at the legal protections and so forth, we can talk about this later, they're not really there, at least in the United States. It's different in Europe than there have been. So pause for one thing in the next slide, which is the thing that has made me most happy, the highlight of this project, has been working with young people, interns and others on this research project, Tony Pino and Chen Fang and others right here, which is just great to see. And one of the things we wanted to do was to say, okay, so it may well be that young people are unlikely to read 388 pages in this format, but we know they love videos, right? They love YouTube. And we know that 3 to 5 minute videos is a really good way to go. And so one thing we did this summer was, with a group of interns, we gave them a little bit of lunch money and so forth, but an environment in which to create versions of this book in digital form. So we sort of threw the book at them and said, what interests you about it? Take a chapter and make a video. Make a video your own interpretation of it. So I want to show you one of those. Videos are always fun for the relaxation of it. But in this next video, this is a young person who has never, in fact, done anything technical. She's about 17 years old. She's from India. Her family's from India. She lives now in Egypt. And she came here and, with basically no additional technical skills, made this interpretation of our dossiers chapter.
Just about all of us have a digital dossier. But many of us have no idea what it even is. Your dossier is the accumulation of all the digital tracks you leave behind. And this accumulation did not just start last week, month, or even year. It started before you were even born. The line between your digital dossier and your identity is constantly shifting. One way to see the implication of this movement is to imagine how information goes into the file of a child born today. Let's call him Andy. The first entry into Andy's file occurs while he's still 5 months into the womb. It is a sonogram, probably framed by his parents, or even forwarded via email to their closest relatives. The same picture will also be copied in Andy's hospital folder and into a file for the pediatrician who will take over after his birth. As the new baby grows, so do the number of items in his digital file. Andy's barcoded bracelet lists facts like gender, time of birth, surname, and more. Friends and family will come to meet the baby, bring gifts, and take more photos, probably with phones or digital cameras. These photos are then also uploaded to other Flickr feeds or Facebook albums as part of the welcoming process. Andy's parents will use their phones to spread the news with SMS text messages, saying something along the lines of, "Healthy baby boy, born 6 pounds at 5:30 p.m. Friends will also post to the Flickr feeds, which will conveniently contain multitudes of Andy's pictures. This process of capturing and spreading pictures will continue for Andy's entire life, with pictures of the first time Andy sits, stands, walks, and talks. As Andy grows, he will now be able to independently share information about himself. He registers as a user on Neopets, where he fills out his name, age, birth date, and other details. Half of the blanks may not be even necessary to fill out, but Andy does not notice the significance of the asterisks as described at the bottom of the page. And so, Andy grows bigger, taller, and broader, and with him grows his digital dossier. As an adolescent, he is sucked into Facebook, where he posts pictures, videos, and information about his likes and dislikes. Facebook, in turn, deposits cookies into his web browser, tracking his activities. He signs up for a Gmail account and regularly uses Google to research for information needed in school assignments. Google, in turn, keeps tabs on all the searches Andy makes from his IP address. In college, he buys books from Amazon, which asks for his mailing address and credit card number. Andy's credit card company adds even more details to his dossier: the date, time, location, and price of every purchase he makes. And as Andy moves around, the GPS in his cell phone enables his service provider to know where he is and how many times he has been there recently. He is also filmed by surveillance cameras whenever he walks into secure college buildings. When Andy gets married, his dossier expands to encompass all the information about his wife, and they start a weblog together to share their thoughts and opinions online. Together, they compile shelf upon shelf of digital tracks, files that are recorded and stored under their names. And when Andy has his first baby, aptly named Andy Jr., the cycle is started all over again. These data points, some publicly accessible, others safeguarded to various degrees by companies and agencies that collect and store this data, make Andy's identity as it forms, even before he himself begins to shape it. And Andy's digital dossier will even grow after his death. Photos or videos of the funeral, RIP messages on MSN Messenger, or his Facebook status posts. Andy probably never knew how large his dossier was. How aware are you of the tracks you leave behind? Want to learn more about your digital dossier?
It's not that Kanya Tiwari is not incredibly smart and incredibly creative. She is, but she didn't have special technical skills, right? This is something that just simply didn't exist And to those who worked on Creative Commons, which was founded at the Berkman Center, you know, some 6 or 7 years ago, the materials that she used were taken from this online repository. So just as we find legitimate threats and concerns, I think we also need to find the good in it and to point to the extraordinary things that young people are doing. So the next issue is intellectual property. Fair enough. Young people do take music that they don't own off of the internet. That's true. And in relatively large numbers, as we found. We didn't debunk that as a myth. What we did also find, though, was that young people didn't have a very good sense of what they could do with materials that they found that others had created, the kinds of things that Terry Fisher has written about with respect to semiotic democracy, the ability to take materials that were in the public to remake them in a way that tells the story of their own generations. There's a lot of confusion both about what's lawful, what's unlawful, but what they can do affirmatively. A second of the videos I wanted to show is the interpretation. It's in three parts, but of some of the issues that were encountered by a young person caught in this snare of intellectual property. This is the Ballad of Zach McCune. Actually, it's only the second part of it.
The hardest part, I realized immediately, was the sense of isolation, which is that you felt kind of cut off from your peers, or at least I did. It felt to me as though everyone was doing it, and somehow I was caught. There was like a persistence of a stigma in a way, too, which is that, like, do I want people to know this about me? Isn't it kind of embarrassing? It felt somehow embarrassing to be caught, to be named in the newspaper, to be kind of the victim of this. Half the people that I would talk to about it would ask me, you know, what should I do? On one hand, I wanted to tell them, you know, hey, be safe. Like, you probably don't want to do it. But on the other hand, I had a very different reaction. I didn't want to help an organization that had hurt me. I was supposed to kind of like infect the mentality that file sharing is okay with this antivirus of, no, it's not okay, it's dangerous. And I kind of ultimately decided to try to go somewhere between those two paths. I eventually started telling almost everybody I knew. You know, people would say something to me like, how you doing, man? How's life? And I'm like, pretty bad. I got sued by the RIAA. And you know, their reaction would usually just be like, whoa, dude. Before I was sued by the RIAA, I never interrogated what I was doing, really. It was an activity that was largely unreflected upon. And as when this was going down, I remember thinking, wow, I did something wrong. And I still believe that I did something wrong. Like, I didn't have a right to take that music. What's just dangerous here is that there's a voice of establishment speaking down on you, which is reigning a morality of, this is right and this is wrong. You don't own this, you can't take it, you can't make with it. And when you read these articles in Wired Magazine, New York Times, you know, major news sources about the music industry losing money, I'm shocked that they can't see the obviousness of, we alienated the most like lucrative consumer pool, being teens and young adults. And when you alienate your primary consumer pool, it's hard to both get them to buy the Britney Spears album while you're busting them for downloading the Britney Spears album, you know? And I think that these things need to be rectified.
So I think this video is cool for the same reason as the last one, the fact that it was an interpretation, in essence, of a chapter of the book. But I also think it points to something that is one of the real findings of this research, which was, I think that the young people who are involved in file sharing, and then often in these remix questions, are very, very, very thoughtful about the role of the author. And in fact, when we put them in the position of the creator, this is what Charlie was talking about with the curriculum, all of a sudden the dynamic changes, that they do see human beings on the other side of these actions. They also see themselves in the position of creating something or remaking it, which is very much a part of everyday life, and have this chance to think about, do I want to become rich? Do I want to sell what I've created? Or do I want to become famous and give it away on the internet? And to think about the fact that there are a series of rights coming in to them that they've had access to, and a series of rights on the outbound side as well. So fourth issue is credibility. This is one that I think is familiar to every teacher, and it pops out very much from the research when talking to high school teachers in particular, which is, how do young people come to know what's credible information and what's not? This is one of the places where, again, the myth was not busted. There's real question about whether or not young people have the skills to discern what's credible from what's not online. And it's coupled with an issue that Urs has worked enormously on, information overload, the extent to which in these digitally mediated lives, young people are absolutely bombarded with information at all times. We can talk about that research, but I think it's a familiar topic to most people. Okay, to end with a positive outlook, I think ultimately, though there are some myths that we need to debunk, there also are many positive things that we should say about what young people are doing here with these technologies. So I think it's crucial to acknowledge these real problems with respect to online safety. There's absolutely the case that young people are meeting people online who then lure them into real space encounters and then do something terrible to them. Absolutely, that's true. But on the other side of this, we have to see also that blocking off these environments, these public spaces in which young people are living, there have been proposals, for instance, to ban all of MySpace for people under 18. Somebody running for governor in this state made that argument. At that level, I think it's missing the fact that a lot of the things that young people are learning in these spaces and the kinds of expressions and development of identity actually themselves are important. On the other side, the intellectual property debate. Yes, it's true that these young people are often doing things that are unlawful, and we need to fix it and we need to figure this out, but they're also making some really extraordinary things if you just bother to click around YouTube for a little bit. And ultimately, if there's a bottom line to what's exciting about this, I really think it is the ability of more people to participate more actively in the making and remaking of their culture, the kinds of things Larry Weber writes about in the marketing space. Hey, John, Larry, nice to see you there. On the credibility side, this is something that, as a librarian, I think it's really important to note that it's absolutely the case that there's information on Wikipedia that's false. It is absolutely true that all the people we talked to, every single young person we talked to, when we said, how do you do your research, they did not say they went to the library. They said they opened a browser, they typed it into Google, they looked for the Wikipedia entry. No doubt that's exactly where most young people are going. But on the other side of that, there is more access to more information than ever before in global history. I think it just makes, in fact, the role of librarians, reference librarians, and others, those who catalog information, all that more important to help young people realize, how do you take advantage of this information environment and find what's credible? Information overload, I think, is much the same story. That yes, it's true that there are concerns about too much information coming in, but I think ultimately we as parents and teachers need to see this as opportunity, as a way to sort through the news and information that we're all living with, and it's not just something that young people themselves face. So just as a final word, as Urs noted, the book that we published, and which I hope some of you will read, was obsolete the minute it was printed this month, right? Absolutely, completely out of date it is, pathetically enough. Larry's already managed to do new editions of his book that came out like 6 months ago. Anyway, everybody has this problem. But the thing that we want to do most of all is to be part of a conversation about how do we make the most of the opportunities that young people have in this digital age? How do we curb the worst of those excesses? And we want that conversation very much to happen online. So if after this you wouldn't mind going to digitalnative.org and logging onto our wiki or playing some of the videos that Diana Kimball and her crew have made, or talk back to us on the blog. We really want this to be a book that, in fact, is part of an ongoing conversation and one where those of you who know much more about any aspect of it are telling us how we got it wrong or helping us figure out how to get it right. So thank you all so much for doing the honor of coming out tonight. It's much appreciated. Is it okay to have a few questions before we go? I wish you would.
Please.
Press your button.
May I have the pleasure of calling on people with questions? Yes, please.
Will you press your button, please? And all right.
I hope people can hear me. I was happy to know that the digital natives start in 1980, but I still am showing my age when the first thing I thought walking in, is the book available on Kindle, or is there somewhere I can download it for free?
It is on Kindle, and parts of it are online for free, and we didn't quite have the market power to pull off the whole thing online for free and get a real publisher. However, it is on Kindle. I will only say one thing about the Kindle edition. I have a Kindle, and I kind of like it. I don't totally love it, but I kind of like it. So Urs and I went to our quite wonderful publisher and said, look, this book is called Born Digital, and I know we don't have the rights to put the whole thing online, but couldn't we come out with the Kindle edition first? And they said, I don't know, maybe, well, we've never done that before. Okay, fine. So sure enough, it came out on the Kindle edition first, and I was giving the first book talk about this at Google Cambridge. I was talking to a group like this, and with some pride said, it's coming out on, you know, the Kindle edition first before the printed one, it's Born Digital and so forth. And a guy in the back row, sure enough, is going on Amazon, raises his hand at the end of the presentation and says, excuse me, it is available on Kindle, that's quite right, but it's $20.43 on Kindle, and it's $17.50 in the hard copy. So there's a little bit of price discrimination going on, and I'm not sure that you really want the Kindle edition. But
really, adopter always gets screwed.
Exactly right. Scoble will fix it. Adam Thier.
Gentlemen, I'm Adam Thier with Progress from Freedom Foundation in Washington. Gentlemen, this is a great book. I really enjoyed it, and I hate to focus on the one thing I think you got wrong when you got so many things right, but I wanted to address your call for a rollback of Section 230. And for many of us on the front lines of policy debates in Washington, Section 230 is really one of the foundational sort of bedrock principles or documents upon which our internet freedom rests. Yeah. And yet, in your online safety chapter, if I may quote.
You may. Quite right.
The scope of the immunity the CDA provides for online service providers is too broad, and there is no reason why a social network site should be protected from liability related to safety of young people simply because its business operates online. Well, I can think of two good reasons why we would not want to have that be the case, because of the absolutely crushing liability that could be associated with deputizing the middleman to be policing all these things, and the chilling effect that would result for online speech and commerce if it was the case that we were holding intermediaries liable for all of these things online. So, guys, why are you against internet freedom?
We love internet freedom, and we love you, Adam, of course. I knew we were going to get it for this, and it's the most provocative thing on a policy level, I think, that we'll say. But Urs, do you want to answer it personally, or no? Thank you. Thank you very much. That's good. It's the chair of the Internet Safety Technical Task Force. Why are you against internet freedom? So I think CDA 230 is a crucial part of internet policy, of course. I do not think a rollback in a literal sense is what we should do, by any means. I think it absolutely plays a critical role with respect to defamation and so forth. The very specific thing that I think is wrong here is that I think these social networks and other digital network spaces ought to have the same level under tort liability to do something reasonable, to take reasonable steps, not to be negligent in this respect. So the famous case, of course, in this is Julie Doe versus MySpace. It's the Texas matter. And in this matter, in essence, CDA 230, which I think was really intended as a speech-related, defamation-related matter, was applied in such a way to say Julie Doe's parents, so the basic facts of the story is what you would imagine, right? So young woman lies about her age, goes online, meets somebody who happens to be older. He meets her offline, does something terrible to her, he gets put in jail for the terrible things. Parents sue MySpace to say, you should have done more to protect her. My argument is, you should at least join the question of whether MySpace had any take any reasonable steps to do that. I don't think they should have a bar from tort liability at that point. I'm quite sure that MySpace, knowing MySpace, that they were doing an ample amount. I don't think they should have been liable in that matter, but I don't think the judgment should, the conversation should have been cut off just because it's an online one. I think the same thing is true in the Craigslist matters. I don't think that Craigslist should, because it's publishing, and this again, I'm sure John Morris is gonna jump out of his chair, if a newspaper publishes something that's a Section 8 discriminatory housing thing, they get potentially liable for that. If an online newspaper of the same sort, in fact, publishes the same, they're not liable. I think they should be treated to the same standard in that in those contexts. So I'm for clarifying what CDA 230 is, and I think the gentlemen from Washington both are going to disagree till the end of the evening. So.
Sure, if I can. But John, I mean,
but John,
how can YouTube carry all those videos and have liability for those YouTubes? And perhaps more importantly, since I think that Google probably can afford to create a system to figure out liability, how can the next new competitor that will be invented by someone in this room create the system with that kind of liability?
You twist the hypothetical there to say, how does YouTube have the liability? I'm not saying YouTube should be liable. In many cases, quite on the record, saying I don't think YouTube should be liable in those cases. What I'm critiquing is saying I don't think there should be a different treatment of these online environments in cases related to kids' safety in particular. I think it's quite a different matter as to whether they ultimately will be held to be liable. That's the question that's been extended too far.
But if they're in court, the startup is dead. The startup no longer has the funding to start up because they're paying a lawyer to fight whether they should be liable, even though
we should probably take it offline. I love startups too, and I disagree with you as to the outcome of making sure that social networks have to have a certain level of non-negligent action to protect kids online. So,
just as a footnote here, might be a point where it's also helpful to look at other jurisdictions, right? For instance, Switzerland, we don't have a safe harbor provision of this sort. And, actually, you would have to ask exactly these questions, right? What would be reasonable steps to be taken by a provider under current standards and, find a balance? And I think from a policy perspective, it's quite reasonable to aim for this balance. That it is very hard to write it down in a law seems to be obvious to me, but just to ignore the problem isn't a much better solution either, I would argue. And it can be hard to explain to parents, right, why social networking sites providers should be treated in a very different way than any other provider or medium would be treated. So I think we have to find a compromise.
There. More for another day.
Yeah. So.
Just to follow up on that, you talked about how you think online social networking sites and forums like Craigslist should have the same liability. But I wasn't clear, what's the offline analogy? Because if you take something like Facebook or MySpace, I mean, the only offline analogy I can think of would be something like a daycare center where there's an expectation that someone's monitoring the children. Online, all they're doing is providing a forum. Likewise with Craigslist, Craigslist isn't publishing anything. Craigslist isn't like an online newspaper. Craigslist is just providing a forum for other people to publish things. So I wasn't sure what the analogy is.
No, it's a really good problem. The analogy is not crisp, necessarily. But I think one of the things this gets at is this incredibly interesting question of what's public and what's private in this digital age. And there's a real blurring of it. And this comes up at various points in the book. I think the most interesting sort of legal analogy are the cases about shopping malls, right? Are those treated as public spaces in which you can be a pamphleteer, or is it a space in which someone owns that and can kick you out? It's not a perfect analogy because there are options. But I think one of the real key issues here is these are the public spaces in which young people are leading their social lives. And for many kids, they feel like this is a way in which they have to engage with other people, good and bad in some cases. So the analogy is not crisp. The thing I would say in the Craigslist case, I think those are ones where a notice and takedown regime, for instance, would be a good one. I don't think Craigslist should be asked not to, you know, to block things on the way up. Likewise with YouTube, something that we do in the music context as well. I think it should be that if somebody points to Craigslist and says, you've got something that discriminates against Section 8 housing people, you have to take it down. Right now they don't, right? So this is a way that one could think about creating some balance there between the way the current system gives them a total free ride and a system in which there's some level of accountability there. So maybe Debbie?
I'm interested in if you as teachers have had any opportunity to observe the effect of the digital experience on the way people think or write or formulate arguments, particularly as you're in a kind of education that's, well, not totally tradition-bound, but it can be fairly formal. And I just wondered whether you've seen any, you're maybe not old enough to see a change, but are you noticing anything that would say is different from maybe when you went to school?
Well, each generation has the tendency to think that things were better when they were younger. Like when I was younger, things were better. I tend to believe that the way arguments are structured, that this has changed. So my students have a different way to build legal arguments, and it's actually quite hard to understand whether, you know, I didn't do a good job to teach them how to build a sound legal argument, or whether it has to do with the way, you know, we argue and we use digital technology to argue. To me, it's more like, it's more linking different arguments together, working with pieces, bits and bytes, and combining them in quite creative ways occasionally, and less a very thorough, almost analogous format, moving from one to two and then from the second point to the third point of the argument, rather than, you know, hopping around, which, you know, it's more networked in a way. It's the arguments are linked together in quite unique ways. So this, but you know, whether it's due to digital technologies, I'm not sure about that.
Maybe this is a good one to end on, so we can in fact go across. But you know, I think one of the key myths that we were trying to work through is this a dumber generation or not, right? And there's a book out there called The Dumbest Generation, and I've read it on my Kindle. And you know, one of the premises of the book is that this group of young people, it's a facile and silly title, but you know, aren't kind of reading long texts and don't retain as many facts and so forth. And I think this is one of the things that we have to work out for ourselves is it just different or is it worse? And Harry Lewis, Berkman Fellow and former Harvard College Dean, has been pushing us on this issue too. I think the point is young people do get news and information really differently than they did before. I think, for instance, with news, they do sort of a grazing process, and then sometimes they deep dive, and sometimes they have a feedback loop and so forth. It's very different than, you know, opening the paper and reading it cover to cover. It's very different than watching Walter Cronkite read you the news at the end of the day. You know, doing reports and studying and so forth, all of these things are quite different. And I think our job as teachers is to say there are new things you can do and there are better ways that you can learn, but we've got to figure out what that is rather than just say, we don't get it. You know, just you keep doing that and we'll keep doing this. And I think ultimately here in this, you know, great learning space, this is what we have to figure out, whether we're law teachers or high school teachers or, you know, parents of three-year-olds ultimately. So I just wanted to say thank you to everybody for coming out and engaging in this conversation, and I hope you'll join us across in the Casperson room.
Thank you.